Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is David Scheel, professor of marine biology at Alaska Pacific University, who has spent over 25 years researching the behavior and ecology of octopuses. And we're talking about his new book, Many Things Under a Rock, The Mysteries of Octopuses. David, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, what's really interesting for me in this book is this really is a lot of insights and observations made while doing either field research or research in a laboratory. So it's really about you observing octopuses.
In some ways, yeah, although I'd like to think it's about my observations of octopuses.
That's what I mean. That's what I was getting at. So it's a very personal book.
Yes.
Now you have to explain the title.
Many Things Under a Rock, The Mysteries of Octopuses. The Many Things Under a Rock comes from an Eyak word, Salux Guk. I'm probably butchering the native pronunciation there, but it's the best I can do. But it's a kind of a compound word, like you know, in English we say sea lion, an animal that lives in the sea and roars like a lion. So it's a compound word like that, and it sort of means many under a rock, many things dwell. So it's many things dwelling under a rock, and because the octopus has 8 arms and thousands of suckers, I thought, well, that kind of fits.
Yeah, they certainly are underneath rocks.
Yeah, and we find them particularly early in the work that I did. The best access I could get to octopuses was during low tides. We'd go out and walk along the beaches in Prince William Sound, Alaska, and the beaches are not sand; they're cobble and boulders and rock and gravel and. Under the boulders, that's where the octopuses would be found.
Now, what drew you first to studying octopuses?
Well, the first time I ever remember being interested in them was when I read Jacques Cousteau's book, The Soft Intelligence. I was probably 12 years old or something like that. So I've been interested in them for a long time.
But weren't you told that octopuses couldn't be studied?
Well, yeah. I mean, when I first proposed to do the work as a scientist, there was a sense that this might be particularly challenging in ways that, studying salmon or herring or something like that might not be. People hadn't really worked out. A lot of the techniques that wildlife biologists use were worked out for what we call fin fish, right? Fish that are actual fish. And these other things like octopuses just behave differently and they have different bodies and everything sort of was a little bit unknown or untried.
Well, and especially after finishing reading your book, octopuses are weird.
A little bit.
Not a little bit. David, not a little bit. You work with them a lot, so you're probably used to it. But they're really weird.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think one of the things I tried to show in the book is as weird as they are, they're pretty much governed by the same things that drive other animals, and they just have diverse ways of addressing the exact same concerns.
You describe them as flexible, boneless, slippery, elusive, clever. And I found them at the end of the book. And I've seen octopuses in the wild diving or on, underneath the water.
Yeah.
But they seem to be, and they're an invertebrate. They're a cephalopod, a type of mollusk. They just seem to be more aware of you than other invertebrates. They have an awareness level that's a little bit unnerving.
I think that's what makes them seem particularly shockingly weird is that, we're talking about an animal whose nearest other animal relatives are you know, the squids and the nautilus. And then from there, you've got to go to snails and clams.
Yeah, you don't get much of a reaction out of a clam. I mean,
Exactly. You really don't. You really don't. And, you know, you can make friends with a snail, but it's a slower sort of business. So the octopus, you know, kind of stands out like that. And so because we have so little expectation of interaction with their relatives. You know, if you compare them to the vertebrates, the animals we're more used to spending time with, they're certainly impressive, but they wouldn't stand out quite so wildly, except that they come from this other branch of the animal kingdom. And that makes things really interesting, because that means that the whole apparatus that the animal uses to be that intelligent and that engaging has evolved on these totally different paths.
They really do seem alien. At one point in the book, you talk about the movie Arrival, and talk about how, like, when I think it was one of your students put their hand on a tank, the octopus automatically did with one or two of its tentacles the same thing.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Often, you know, this doesn't happen in the wild very often unless you can go back and visit the same octopus over and over again. But once they get familiar with the way things work in the lab or in captivity, octopuses that aren't seeing people every minute of every day, and this might not work in a public aquarium, but octopuses that get to know you, if you put your hand up on the tank, splay it out, they'll come and sit over your hand on the other side of the glass with their arms splayed out and kind of make eye contact with you, looking between their arms to do it, because they have to, you know. So it's kind of an interesting suggestive behavior. I've never done any rigorous science to sort of test it, but I've seen it, you know, dozens and dozens of times over the years.
Well, and the other side of the coin is, if they don't really like you, they'll squirt you.
Yes, if they can get a chance.
How far can they squirt?
It's pretty impressive, actually. You know, there was one time I captured an octopus and had on board of the boat in a temporary tank, you know, like a 15-gallon tank, and it was a medium-sized giant Pacific octopus, so it was fairly large. But I was just taking some photos, and the octopus emptied, you know, probably half the water in the tank.
Oh, my God.
and, you know, in a couple of great big squirts, it hit me pretty squarely in the face and the chest, you know. Amused my daughter.
So they're carefully aiming this.
They seem to be, yeah. Yeah, they know where they're pointing it, yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because underwater, in their natural habitat, you know, they use that siphon. They have to aim that siphon. It's part of their It's part of how they move around, the jet propelled part of everything. And then they also use it to blow water at fish, for example. If somebody's pestering them, some little fish is pestering them, they'll blow water at it. And they can aim it at they use it for a lot of things. They use it to blow debris out of their den. And then I talk about this towards the end of Many Things Under Rock. In Australia, we've seen them pick up loads of shells or sediment, and by tucking that siphon underneath their body, they're able to blow it on the debris, which propels whatever they're holding, which they release at the moment they squirt at it, and it propels whatever they're holding at their neighbors. And so they're throwing loads of debris and shells at one another down there. And they seem to be aiming those, too. It seems like those are probably directed on at annoying individuals with the intent to sort of discourage them a little bit.
Would you ever use the word mischievous? Or is that too anthropocentric?
Well,
just be honest, David.
This is a particular context, right? They certainly act in ways that are mischievous, but that isn't to say that
it
they
is.
Have mischief in their hearts when they do it.
But we have no idea.
Yeah, we have no idea. But certainly, yeah, I mean, they do things that create mischief. whether their goal is to create mischief, I wonder about that. But they certainly want to provoke a reaction.
Okay.
I think that's one of the reasons. One of the things I thought is, like, people always say, okay, they squirt you when they don't like you. And I put that in the book because
it
seems entirely reasonable. But the other possibility is they squirt the people that give them the biggest reaction back. So if you're a very reactive person, right? If they squirt you and nothing happens, your odds of getting squirted again might be pretty low. If they squirt and you jump back and you get a big reaction, that's very entertaining. They've made a big impact.
But that's fairly sophisticated consciousness.
Well, like I said, these are just speculations. I've never really tested that, but it seems like a reasonable. It seems like a reasonable alternative to the like-dislike idea.
Wow. Well, let's talk about some basics of the octopus. And that's the great thing about this book is you go through a lot of different aspects of their behavior and their ecology. I think people might be surprised to know that they're bilaterally symmetrical, not radially symmetrical.
Yeah. I mean, they're bilaterally symmetrical, left to right. One side looks like the other. So they have, you know, two eyes and a gill slit on either side and four arms on either side. And then they have this secondary radial symmetry because the arms, if you think about it, the mouth is underneath on the suckered side, and it's at the center of all the arms.
Yeah.
So the arms are like this extended prehensile lips. But because the arms are also used for moving around and help them direct how they act with the world, that creates this secondary symmetry around the mouth, so they have this secondary radial symmetry. But yeah, they're actually bilaterally symmetrical, sort of underneath that.
One of the most amazing parts of this book, of several amazing parts, is when you start to write about their senses. They're very much centered on eyesight and touch. They don't see color, but they see polarized light. How is that useful for them?
I mean, the simplest way to think about this is what happens to light underwater. So when you're a couple inches underwater, light seems really bright, especially like in the tropics. If you go to Hawaii and you swim around or something like that, or Florida, and the bright sunlight, there's a lot of color underwater. But in murky water, or if you go deeper, that color fades out very quickly. You lose the various wavelengths of light. Blue penetrates the furthest. Red penetrates the least. And the way human vision works, because we kind of anticipate what colors things will be, we don't see the world as black and white as it really is down below. And so if you go down below and you're at 60 or 70 or 80 feet deep in clear water, or even shallower than that in murky water, you're going to have this experience that the light's dimmer, but things are still colorful. But if you take pictures without flash down there, you'll discover there's very little color left in the light itself. So color vision isn't that useful below the very shallowest portions of the ocean anyway. But polarized light vision, light is polarized when it hits a flat reflective surface, like the shiny scales of a fish. So underwater, the light is kind of scattered in all directions and it's not polarized. But then it reflects off something shiny like a predator or food, and it gets polarized. And to someone who can see polarized vision, who can see polarized light, and humans can't. We don't detect that within our senses. It jumps out in the same way that, like, glare jumps out at us. Glare is polarized light on the surface, and it seems very bright to us because you've got this bright reflective surface. It's reflecting more light. We're not detecting the polarization. We're just detecting the quantity. But a fish can, or an octopus, I'm sorry, can see the polarization. And so that jumps out from the background.
Wow.
And so because color is really subdued underwater. But polarized light is polarized locally. So it like hits the fish and it's polarized in reflection. It still pops underwater. And so that's why they have this sort of very different sense of the quality of light than humans do. Humans, the quality of light, color is very important. For octopuses, the quality of light, polarization, is very important.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is David Scheel, professor of marine biology at Alaska Pacific University. He has spent over 25 years researching the behavior and ecology of octopuses, and we're talking about his new book. It's a great read. Many Things Under a Rock, The Mysteries of Octopuses. I think one of the most amazing abilities of octopuses for me, and I've seen many films of this, is the way they can change color, patterns, and even texture. I've never seen another. I mean, I've seen animals certainly change color, not like an octopus.
Yeah, you know, it's octopuses and to some extent squids. This color changing ability that they have is unparalleled in the animal kingdom. It's just unique to them. It's all muscularly controlled, and they have these little organelles in their skin that can be pulled open by the muscles to expose the color, or when the muscles relax, the thing pops closed again and the color drops down to a little tiny pinpoint. So it's in many ways parallel to sort of a pixel system in our modern-day electronic screens.
But they even change texture.
Yeah, they can do so. So they have several layers of color. They have reflective cells and that reflect the ambient color. They have diffusive cells that reflect white, and then they have different colors that they can display. But then they also have a system of pulling bumps and texture up erect in their skin, so they can make papillae pop up or vanish.
Wow.
So you get sort of these very small elements of color patches, and then they form these bigger patterns, and then the patterns can also be modified by popping up different texture on top of them.
Now we have to talk about their use of ink. What is the ink made out of?
The ink is melanin, the same pigment that we have in our skin, and mucus. And it's the two parts are created in different, secreted by different glands within the octopus. They store the ink in an ink sac, and then when they eject the ink, they can mix the amount of melanin they want with the amount of mucus they want to get a sort of a more dense cloud with a lot more color in it, or a more mucusy cloud that holds together a lot more.
So they can, and they choose which ones they're going to use, right?
They seem to, yeah. This is better studied in squids than it is in octopuses, but yeah, they seem to, they can, you know, the idea can be if they put a sufficient amount of mucus in there, they can create this blob that turn out to be about the same size as their body, and it hangs together in the water, you know, for tens of seconds. And so it provides something that a predator will attack. And I've actually seen video of that, of like a in a big battle between an octopus and a moray eel that I wrote about in And the moray gets kind of thrashed in the end. But when the octopus finally escapes, the moray turns around and bites into one of its ink clouds. or they can create a more diffuse thing that will kind of disperse more quickly, but create a much, much bigger, more diffuse cloud. And that probably just serves to obscure where they are. Mostly they seem to create these little decoys, little bursts of ink that that hang in the water.
Okay, we're going to run out of time before we finish everything I want to talk about, but I got to talk about the octopus nervous system. As you write about in the book, 2/3 of their neurons are distributed throughout their body, and there's a lot of neurons in their arms. And so as you talk about in the book, you have to ask the question, is the octopus actually thinking with their arms?
Well, you know, that's a great question, because The other thing you realize is octopuses often get damaged in the wild. And one of the ways they can get damaged is lose a chunk of an arm or all of an arm. And the arms, even when they're detached from the body, right, still cling to things. The suckers still move. The arms can still move along a surface. And it seems like there's a lot of going on in the arms there. And so the question then comes, you know, are they thinking for themselves, like you just said? But I think maybe a better analogy is each arm has a major nerve cord that runs down the center of it. And those are a little bit like eight individual spinal columns in a way.
Wow, wow.
Right? There's a lot of nerves in there. There's a lot of processing power. And every sucker is attached to that axial nerve cord, that center nerve cord. And so there's so much body to control, with all of the suckers needing control and all of the arms, that a lot of the processing power is really based out in the arms. And the brain is initiating controls and responding to things, but a lot of the times the information doesn't need to go all the way back to the brain. If the octopus is just passing things from sucker to sucker, all of that can happen along in the arm. The brain can inhibit it or initiate it, and then the arm can just handle all the coordination of one sucker to its neighbors.
Now, octopuses also have stereotypical poses that they can do to convey attitude. Talk about those. Wasn't one called Nosferatu?
I'm fortunate enough to work sometimes with collaborators in Australia. There's a site there where we nicknamed it Octopolis, where there's just maybe 15 or 20 octopuses in one area. 20 might be a slight exaggeration, but somewhere in that number. And so they're interacting with each other just constantly. And this is
but that's odd, because octopuses are generally solitary, right?
Yeah. It's a very unusual place. Maybe not quite as unusual as we might have thought when we first discovered it, but yeah, it's very unusual. And we've seldom had a chance to see octopuses interacting with one another. And one of the things they do is during an interaction, you know, the sort of more aggressive or you know, larger animal will stand up very tall and spread its arms out, pull its web down. So it just looks like this dark and turn very dark. And so it looks like this dark, ominous figure in a cloak. And we took to calling this pose the Nosferatu after the, I think it was like a 1920s silent.
No, it's a silent German film, a vampire film.
Yeah, exactly. Because this guy looks just so dark and ominous, and he's got this, you know, his web looks like a cloak or something. And the other animal then typically lies very flat and spreads out a little wide on the bottom and puts on this high, instead of being dark, it puts on this high contrast pattern, a mixture of blotches of dark and light. And that seems to signal, I don't want any trouble. Because if the other octopus also stands up very tall, maybe he's feeling very prickly as well, or feels like maybe the other guy's not as big as the other guy thinks he is, then this often escalates into some sort of wrestling match. But if one of them is doing the Nosferatu and the other one's laying down quite low, typically then, you know, one of them will retreat, or they'll slip by one another without the same kind of trouble.
Now, we just have a few minutes left, literally just like three or four. I've got to talk to you about sleeping octopuses. And this is a fascinating section of your book. Is there a feeling that they may dream?
Yeah, I mean, the sense is probably a lot of animals dream. So sleep is this area that has received more scientific attention somewhat recently, over the last 15 years or so, than maybe it had previously. When I started with octopuses, no one had really studied whether they sleep or not at all. But the consensus in the intervening years has been that not only do octopuses sleep, but probably fruit flies sleep, and you know, all kinds of animals sleep.
But odd things happen to octopuses when they sleep.
That could
lead you to think that they're dreaming.
Yeah, there's two phases of sleep, sort of an active twitching phase and a less active, deeper sleep. And in humans, during the active phase, which we call REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, that's a lot of dreaming happens then. Not all of it, but a lot of dreaming. And it seems likely that in octopuses, you might be able to tell if they were dreaming by watching their body patterns, because those are the sorts of movements that aren't suppressed when you're asleep during, you know, this more active twitching phase of sleep, these little tiny muscle movements. And so I suggest in the book, and I wrote a paper about this, that, you know, if they're dreaming, we might be able to learn something about it by watching those body patterns. But those detailed studies haven't been done yet. But I do think it's very likely, based on what we know about octopuses and dreaming, that they dream. And, I suspect our dogs and our cats and probably, you know, our birds dream as well. I don't think it's unique to octopuses.
But it is interesting to think about what they're dreaming of.
Yes. What do octopuses dream of?
Fat crabs. Something of
crabs, or maybe contests with other octopuses, or maybe just a really good, finding a really good den.
That's perfect. We're completely out of time, but you should know that's incredibly important. Octopuses live in a world very dangerous for them. And that's one of the things I learned also about in this book. My guest tonight has been David Scheel, professor of marine biology at Alaska Pacific University, who spent over 25 years researching the behavior and ecology of octopuses. And he's written a book all about his work, Many Things Under a Rock, The Mysteries of Octopuses. David, it's been a real pleasure.
Pleasure to talk to you, Mark. Thank you for having me on your show.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.